Es kristallisiert sich ja nach diesen drei anfänglich oder augenscheinlich doch sehr unterschiedlichen Themen doch ein ziemlich klares Muster heraus. Die Aspirationen des Iran könnten höher nicht gesteckt sein, ganz offensichtlich. Wir sind damit vertraut, dass wir von einer regionalen, von Aspirationen sprechen, eine regionale Vorherrschaft einzunehmen, aber hier geht es sogar darum, den nächsten Weltkrieg zu gewinnen. Die Mittel, die Wahl der Mittel ist von keinerlei Einschränkung gezeichnet. Das reicht von Täuschen, Tarnen etc. etc. in den Verhandlungen um die Atomwaffen. Das reicht immer noch bis hin natürlich etwas, was Sie gesagt haben, eine Rücksichtslosigkeit, was hauptsächlich, und ich glaube, das ist ein interessanter und auch wichtiger Punkt zu betonen, die sich hauptsächlich gegen die eigenen Leute richtet. Das ist gleich, ob sich das im Iran, ob das im Iran war gegen die eigene Bevölkerung oder eben auch, wie wir das im Irak sehen, das wird sehr oft unter den Tisch, unter den Teppich gekehrt, dass ja die größte Zahl der Opfer im Irak Irakis selbst sind, also der Anschläge von Al-Qaida. Und das geht natürlich bis hin zum Export der Revolution, bei dem wir uns nicht einbilden müssten, dass Deutschland in irgendeiner Weise ein Territorium sei, an dessen Grenzen steht, Hisbollah ist hier unerwünscht und das auch dann dementsprechend eingehalten werden würde. Es ist aber auch ein Schlüsselsatz gefallen in Ihrem Beitrag, den ich immer wieder sehr interessant finde, gleich ob es sich um terroristische Aktionen handelte, wie Entführungen etc. In dem Moment, wo Tough Action eingetreten ist, in dem Moment, wo gehandelt wurde, ob das George Bush war, der die Praxis des Kidnappings unterbrochen hat, ist tatsächlich eine Wirkung eingetreten. Das heißt, wir haben es offensichtlich nicht mit einem Regime zu tun, das sich gänzlich das Einschüchterungen gegenüber oder einer sehr klaren Haltung gegenüber ganz uneinsichtig oder unempfindlich wäre. Fangen wir doch mal mit der in der Tat apokalyptischsten und größten Bedrohung an, nämlich dem Aufbau eines militärisch zu militärischen Zwecken entwickelten Nuklearprogramms. Sie haben es ja gesagt, Jossi Mellmann, wenn diplomatische und wirtschaftliche Maßnahmen nicht greifen, dann wird es militärische Maßnahmen geben. Aber was wären denn die Art von diplomatischen oder ökonomischen Maßnahmen, die Sie als wirksam empfinden würden? Und als Nachtrag zu der Frage auch noch, wie wichtig ist es, Russland und China im Boot zu behalten, was ja gleichzeitig immer, und das sagt ja selbst das Kanzleramt, eine ungeheure Verzögerung ist, weil man die immerzu mit irgendwelchen Minimalzugeständnissen im Boot sitzt, aber sonst springen die immer gleich wieder raus.
I want to tip the balance of my bleak presentation by providing a more light into this discussion. And you kind of touched upon it by saying that Iran can be deterred. There is a lot of bravado in the Iranian rhetorics. I mean, we have to take them seriously about their readiness and desire to respond and to revenge, but they also there is also a limit to what they can do. So Iran, despite its horrendous regime and its atrocities, is attentive to a certain degree to the world. And if the world is putting a pressure on Iran, they are listening. If the world is weak and soft, the international community, they take advantage of it. Now, we have an example. In 2003, under the moderate president of Khatami, they halted their nuclear program, their uranium enrichment. Why? Because there was a pressure, because of the American invasion of Iraq. They feared that they are next to be targeted. So they are masters of maneuvering between pressures. And if there is a strong economic pressure. Now, I don't believe and I don't trust the United Nations Security Council is possible of reaching a consensus to punish Iran with significant sanctions. This is because of China and the rules played by China and the Soviet Union. However, if the EU is taking strong measures, financial measures to stop any investment in Iran. Iran is desperately in need of foreign investment, especially in their energy, oil and gas sector. Their oil sector is in a very bad situation, deteriorating every day. They are losing nearly 10% of their oil production due to bad equipment, due to the smuggling of oil to neighboring Turkey and other countries. So financial investment in Iran, especially in the oil section, in the energy section, an effort to stop the sale of high-tech and sophisticated computers, high-tech and technology would put a pressure on the regime. And I believe that it is still not too late to avoid the military confrontation by increasing this pressure, even though Russia and China are not in line. Now, it is not out of question that we can also that the EU, above all, can pressure China. The Olympics are on the horizons. If it is, and it is very important, it is very, very important to the Chinese government to have good, solid Olympic Games. There is still time to put the pressure on them to be in accordance and in line with the rest of the international community. It's not out of the question. We just heard recently that the Swiss government is clinching a huge gas deal with Iran. We just heard that the Austrian government, Austrian corporation, is going to have a major gas deal with Iran. And one would wonder, why are they doing it? I can understand why they are doing it. But they also have the moral obligation. It's not only economics. Eventually, Europe would be targeted by Iran. If the Europeans believe that this is a matter between some tribal wars in the Middle East between those crazy fanatic Iranians and these Jewish zealots or whatever, it eventually will reach you too. So if you are concerned about your own safety, not only due to some moral questions, historical questions, it is your obligation as a government, as the public, to put the pressure on Iran, on your own corporations to stop their deals with Iran. Thank you.
One more quick question in this regard, and this is about deterrence. Israel so far has followed a politics of ambivalence concerning its own nuclear capabilities. Would it be an option to say, well, listen, Iran, we do have nuclear capabilities and quite some good ones, and you better don't strike first? Meaning that Israel would have to lay open its own nuclear capabilities?
I personally believe that what is known as the ambiguity policy, that Israel does have nuclear weapons but has never admitted that they have it, and it is a very wise policy, because it is helping Israel not to be under pressure, especially from the Americans. The world and the United States can live with the notion that Israel is not admitting that it has nuclear weapons. Now, if Israel at this moment would admit that they have nuclear weapons, it only would strengthen the Iranian position, saying they have nuclear weapons, they admitted they have nuclear weapons, why not? We are allowed to have it. So I think, generally speaking, I am against changing the policy, but especially in this particular important junction.
As you noted, I spoke about the usefulness of tough policy against Iran. I should have said it's useful to force Iran to make tough choices. That is, Iran should be confronted between a tough choice between a large stick and a large carrot. And that carrot element is quite useful. That is to say, Iran should be offered incentives if it cooperates.
What would be the incentives?
After the Iran stopped its campaign of killing Iranian dissidents in Europe, Europe resumed normal economic relations with Iran. And I think that was, on the whole, a wise thing to do. So I would favor a willingness to use economic incentives. I am worried that the Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, the principal incentive that he wants is he wants to see the West stop criticizing Iran's human rights record and to stop its broadcasting to Iran, because he worries about a velvet revolution. He is much more concerned about Western success at turning his people against him than he is about military invasion. He worries more about cultural invasion than military invasion. And I think it would be very unfortunate and inappropriate if the West agreed to stop criticizing Iran's human rights record and to halt or even change the character of broadcasting to Iran in return for Iran's cooperation on nuclear matters. There is not much that the West can do to help those fighting for democratic Iran, but we should take what limited steps we can, and we certainly should not let the Islamic Republic tell its people that the West does not care about you, the Iranian people. So I would oppose doing a deal with Iran in which Iran cooperates on nuclear matters and the West stops the policy that Iran calls a policy of regime change. For to be blunt, when Iran talks about regime change, what they are afraid of is what happened in Eastern Europe, namely these kinds of velvet revolutions where these regimes collapse from within. For that is Khomeini's reading of what happened in Iran from 1997 to 1999. Namely, his reading is that the West successfully got the Iranian people to abandon the Islamic Republic and that it almost collapsed from within. And that is why this last year he threw in jail for 8 months a 67-year-old Iranian-American grandmother who he accused of trying to bring down the Islamic Republic. And in a television show about why she and three other Iranian Americans, including the head of the Open Society Initiative, financed by George Soros, were put in jail, the Iranian regime figures explained that George Soros and George Bush meet regularly to discuss how to bring down the Islamic Republic. Now, anyone who knows George Soros or George Bush might find it surprising the idea that they cooperate together. The television show went on to have the Deputy Minister of Intelligence explain that any university professor who talks to or writes to a foreigner should be regarded with suspicion because he could be a spy. Now, when you have a regime that takes that kind of attitude towards people-to-people exchanges, we have a problem. And I do not think that we should abandon the Iranian people who are willing to be thrown in jail for their efforts to speak to foreigners, even if we get a deal on nuclear matters.
Well, obviously, a regime change in the long run would be the most elegant and good for all option of all options we have. But from what I understand is the problem is a bit more immediate. To say the least. And I'd like to turn again back to economic sanctions. I mean, look at Germany. Germany is one of the biggest economic partners and most important economic partners. And here I hear issues like, let's not export high-tech material to to Iran, because sanctions and obviously reaching something, and it obviously is, I don't know how well it is understood, but it's obviously in all our interest, not only in Israel's interest, but in all our interest to stop this nuclear program. That much we can agree on. Now, obviously, also we have to search for actions that hurt most at the places where it's best for us. And I still have to turn back the question of economic sanctions to you. What about those sanctions? Well, it would be a bit more immediate, a bit more hurtful.
You know, the United Nations ordered that all trade with Iraq stop. It was halted for 12 years. Now, I think the Iraqi government exaggerates when it says that 500,000 Iraqi children died as a result. But this imposed tremendous suffering on the Iraqi people. It did not lead to a change in Iraqi government policy. That is a lesson worth contemplating. What has been adopted so far by the United Nations has been described by some as symbolic and ineffective sanctions. I don't agree. I think they're highly targeted sanctions. The United Nations has adopted tough rules against the export of anything to Iran that could be used to help Iran's nuclear or missile program. That is a very worthwhile goal. And my problem with the actions of the U.S. government, of the German government, and of the European Union is that we are doing extremely little to implement those rules. And in particular, we are doing exactly nothing. Nothing. To help governments like Argentina, Malaysia, India, which lack the resources to know whether or not Iran is buying those things through clandestine means in their territory. When Europe got serious about the sanctions on the former Yugoslavia, now Serbia, Europe formed a group of over 500 customs people who went to help Serbia's neighbors, now mostly members of the European Union, but then were not, to implement those UN sanctions. Similarly, there is much that Europe and the United States could do to make the existing UN sanctions tougher and to slow down Iran's nuclear program. May I call your attention to the last report from the International Atomic Energy Agency, in which it said that Iran had stopped making the centrifuges it was making before, because they weren't working very well. In fact, in the last 3 months, they made less enriched uranium they had in the previous 3 months, which is not a sign of progress. And the new centrifuges that Iran is making is a design which Iran did not want to have to use, but has to use because it could not acquire the material it wanted from abroad. So Iran still needs vital materials for its program from abroad. The UN has banned the sale of that stuff, and we are not doing very much to help enforce those resolutions.
Möchte ich Ihnen doch jetzt endlich auch die Gelegenheit geben, Fragen zu stellen. Haben wir ein Mikro im Raum? Wunderbar. Jeffrey Hurf hat sich zuerst gemeldet und dann der Herr, der in der fast gleichen Reihe, eine Reihe hinter ihm am Rande sitzt. Genau. Und dann
Sie. Ist es an? Yes, I am Jeffrey Herf. First, Alexander Ritzman, perhaps you've read Philip Bobbitt's Terror and Consent. Do you think that the Iranian government would give nuclear weapons to Hezbollah and Hamas and other terrorist groups? A number of people have written about the wars of the 21st century and that this might be something that we need to think about. And to Yossi Melman, how good is Western intelligence about what is going on in Iran compared, for example, to what we thought we knew was going on in Iraq? And related to that is the question that you and Benny Morris raised regarding deterrence and preemption. It gets very much to the point raised this morning about what Patrick Clausen called the nonsense about the 12th Imam, and that is, how do the leaders of the Iranian government, not the Iranian people, not the most of the Iranian parliament, but the leaders of the Iranian government, how do they regard the prospect of their own death? Do they view it as something to be avoided or something to be welcomed? And if it's something to be welcomed, then we're in a very different situation than the system of nuclear deterrence that the West was able to sustain for over half a century with the communists, who, after all, were atheists and didn't think about the next world.
Gerne. Würde der Iran Hezbollah oder Hamas Atomwaffen zur Verfügung stellen, wenn er könnte? Ich glaube, prinzipiell würde der Iran Hezbollah und Hamas zur Verfügung stellen, was auch immer er glaubt, dem Ziel dient, also dem Ziel des Machterhalts, dem Ziel des Exports der islamischen Revolution und anderen Zielen. Ich glaube aber, wenn wir natürlich über Gruppierungen wie Hezbollah und Hamas sprechen, dann gehen wir ja nicht davon von Langstreckenraketen oder Ähnlichem aus, sondern geht es ja eher wahrscheinlich um die sogenannten Dirty Bombs, also konventionelle Sprengsätze gemischt mit gering strahlendem atomaren Material. Ich glaube, dass das schon möglich wäre im Moment. Ich meine, wir wissen ja alle oder wir glauben zu wissen, dass ja Dutzende von Sprengköpfen und Tonnen von atomarem Material nach dem Zusammenbruch der UdSSR verschwunden sind. Ich weiß nicht, wo die ganzen Sachen sind. Sie sind irgendwo. Und ich glaube schon, dass der Iran als Regime und auch die Hezbollah mit ihrem Netzwerk, den Finanzen, auch der Intelligenz, die dort vorhanden ist, in der Lage wäre, problemlos schmutzige Bomben, also mit atomarem Material, Sprengsätze jetzt schon herzustellen und irgendwo in Berlin hochgehen zu lassen. Es ist nicht in deren strategischem Interesse im Moment. Das heißt, es gibt die Kosten-Nutzen-Abwägung. Was wäre das Resultat eines solchen Anschlages? Scheint dazu zu führen, dass dieses Mittel nicht eingesetzt wird. Ich bin aber fest davon überzeugt, dass der Iran sowohl wie zumindest die Hezbollah in der Lage wäre, auf diesem Level atomare Anschläge zu verüben, aber natürlich nicht in dem Level, wenn man jetzt über Atomwaffen spricht, im Sinne von Langstreckenraketen oder Ähnlichem.
My answer is to Jeff is yes, the intelligence now is much better than it used to be in the past regarding Iran, but also Iraq. Now, in the comparison between Iran and Iraq, I think there is a one major distinction, which is perceptual. I tend to believe that the Bush administration wanted to finish off Saddam Hussein and set the target and then was looking for the evidence, intelligence evidence and otherwise. While in the Iranian case, the evidence is there. I mean, to a certain degree, maybe it's not sufficient, but there is evidence that Iran is building, is heading to have a nuclear bomb. It is stated not only by intelligence estimates and reports, but also by the IAEA. Now, Patrick mentioned that Iran is having difficulties to acquire equipment and know-how and technology abroad. And partly this is because there is an increased awareness in the international community and increased cooperation between intelligence communities. I know that there is a good cooperation between the Israeli intelligence and the CIA and the BND here and some other, and the MI6 and some other organizations, and they share information on Iran with each other. They tip each other about potential shipments of weapons of technology, and this is, it is working. Now, as far as what do we know, or what the intelligence communities know about Iran, this is more problematic, but I think that they know a great deal, and that their military planners in Israel and in America are already working on what is called targeting. So they know at least the very basic, fundamental sites in which Iran is involved in its nuclear program. It's much better than it used to be because there is an increased awareness to the threat of Iran.
Just a word on that. Yossi, I hope you're right.
But I would just like to suggest that the lesson that the International Atomic Energy Agency drew after its inspections in Iraq in 1991, after that war, its inspections in North Korea in 1994-95, and its involvement in the Libyan handover of nuclear material, and in its earlier inspections of the South African nuclear program in the early 1980s, and its inspections in Iraq after the 2003 war, and its inspections in Iran in 2004-2005. In each one of those cases, the conclusion of the international inspectors was dramatically at odds with what they had expected to find, and was dramatically at odds with what Western intelligence agencies had unanimously concluded was the case. Now, given that historical record, I would just suggest that we should be very, very modest in any statements we make about what we know about Iran's nuclear program. And my biggest criticism of the National Intelligence Estimate of last December was the number of times that they said that we assess with high confidence that whatever. I would hope they could be a bit more modest.
We have five more questions. I hope we'll have the time for those five. Just one question that I think that interests all of you, and it was asked here, is simply put, how mad is Ahmadinejad and the people around him who are in charge of it? Are they mad enough to have themselves killed, or are they reasonable enough to be deterred?
We have a very nice study on our website by a fellow who studied 14 years in Qom and knows these people very well personally. And the answer is that the leaders of the Islamic Republic are profoundly superstitious, believe a great deal of nonsense. Khamenei is on the record saying that he firmly believes that with enough faith, he can teleport himself any place on earth. But there is no evidence that any of their leaders, including Ahmadinejad, believe that in order to bring about the return of the 12th Imam, it is useful or necessary to start a war. There is no evidence that they believe that. They believe that when the 12th Imam comes, he will start a war. But they do not believe that starting a war is a way to hasten the return of the 12th Imam. Indeed, they vigorously debate among themselves if there is anything that humans can do to hasten the return of the 12th Imam. As for their own personal attitudes towards their death, it has frequently been commented by Iranian writers that one of the reasons the Islamic Republic so honors martyrs is because how few Iranians are prepared to die for their cause, and that those who have died in these suicide bombings have not been Iranian. They have been Arab, they have been Afghan, but they have not been Iranian.
Even if Patrick is right and the research that was written by the Institute is correct, still, I think there is a general consensus here that it is not advisable that they would have nuclear weapons even if they don't use it for the hastening of the Messiah. It reminds me, my comparison is, would we provide matches to a fire maniac? I wouldn't do it.
Ich werde jetzt drei Fragen sammeln. Bitte erstmal drei. Ich weiß, es sind noch einige sozusagen in der Pipeline. Aber vielleicht halten Sie sich bitte so kurz wie möglich. Wenn es ähnlich ist, können unsere Referenten das dann auch in einem Abwasch beantworten. Sie zuerst und dann der Herr in dem Polunder und dann Sie.
Ja, mit dem Kurzen ist natürlich immer so eine Sache. Die Frage geht an Herrn Mellmann. Und zwar bezüglich der militärischen Option Israels. Meiner Ansicht nach sind zwei Möglichkeiten da. Die erste ist, und das wird derzeit geübt, Sie müssen also die Flugzeuge unterwegs auftanken und Sie brauchen Spezialbomben, weil im Gegensatz damals zu 81 die Anlagen im Iran weitgehend disloziiert sind und zum Teil tief verbunkert. Das ist nicht ohne weiteres machbar. Wenn Sie es tun, wird es das ganze Problem verzögern, aber nicht lösen. Zweite Sache, Israel ist dabei, sich eine Zweitschlagkapazität zuzulegen, indem sie ihre Raketen auf U-Boote verlagern, übrigens Boote, die von Deutschland geliefert worden sind, mit Brennstoffzellenansätzen, die also praktisch kaum ortbar sind. Die Frage ist, wie weit ist ein Regime wirklich bereit, Selbstmord zu begehen, wenn man weiß, dass der erste Schlag in jedem Fall derjenige ist, wie es im Kalten Krieg auch war, wer zuerst schießt, stirbt als Zweiter. Ist das wirklich rational?
Der Herr dort drüben mit dem grünen Schild und dem Polunder, gleich in dieser Reihe, genau.
Ja, ich heiße Martin Rau und ich wollte sagen, dass ich also nicht glaube, dass Gut und Böse da so schön verteilt sind.
Nur um das gleich, wollen Sie eine Frage stellen? Weil
ich wollte ein Statement abgeben.
Nein, Statements können, dafür haben wir keine Zeit, danke. Dann geht die Frage direkt an Sie weiter.
Danke. Mein Name ist Hans-Jakob Ginzburg, ich bin Journalist. Frage an Yossi Mellmann. Militärische Optionen Israels. Gestern Abend hat hier Professor Benny Morris die Meinung vertreten, jeder konventionelle Schlag gegen den Iran sei letztlich sinnlos, weil das Regime, das überlebt, sich radikalisiert und die Bedrohung nur wächst. Morris vertritt den Standpunkt, im Grunde gehe nichts anderes als ein präventiver israelischer Nuklearschlag. Können Sie dazu etwas sagen?
Erst diese und dann sehen wir, dass wir noch zwei aufnehmen.
First of all, as I said in my opening remarks, I believe that despite the difficulties, Israel is capable of launching a military strike against Iran's nuclear sites and some other communication centers, and I wouldn't discuss. I'm not a military expert in that sense. How it would be done, but as I said earlier, I'm sure the planners are already working on targeting. And as for the other question, I am totally against what Benny Morris suggested yesterday. I don't think that any nation on earth is allowed to use at this stage nuclear weapons as a preemptive means to prevent Iran or any other country of having nuclear weapons. I think conventional weapons are sufficient to stop Iran at least for a few more years, and I don't know what will happen to Iran after being attacked. I mean, a lot of people here said about the discontent in Iran itself. So a military strike against the regime, against the Ayatollahs, may trigger a chain reaction in Iran itself. But obviously, it would stop Iran of reaching nuclear weapons at least for 5, 6 or who knows, many, many more years.
Für zwei, wenn Sie sich wirklich sehr knapp fassen, haben wir noch Zeit. Hier vorne war der Herr, der sich am längsten schon gemeldet hat, und dann Sie, Benjamin Weinthal, als nächstes. Erst Sie und dann Sie. Ja, ich weiß, aber ich kann ja nichts dafür. Die Reihenfolge ist die Reihenfolge. Was soll ich machen? Ich mache jetzt keine Frauenquote, wenn es nicht in der Reihenfolge ist.
Eine Frage an Herrn Ritzmann. Sie haben von Vogel-Strauß-Politik gesprochen, der deutschen Politik gegenüber Iran. Wir haben gestern gehört, es geht durchaus um langfristige strategische Optionen. Es geht doch um politische Auseinandersetzungen innerhalb vom Establishment, auch wenn darüber nicht berichtet wird. Ich wollte Sie fragen, Sie haben ja eine klare Position hier vertreten. Wie schätzen Sie die Kräfteverhältnisse ein für die bezüglich der Fraktion, die, wie die Politikberater sagen, vom Partner Iran spricht und der Fraktion, die den Iran als Bedrohung, als globale Bedrohung, als Bedrohung für Israel ernst nimmt? Und glauben Sie überhaupt, dass es möglich ist, sozusagen hier ein Politikwechsel stattfindet? Sie können das ja gerne illustrieren mit Ihrer eigenen politischen Erfahrung, mit den Diskussionen, die Sie haben mit Kollegen und so weiter.
Können wir es gleich weitergeben, noch hier vorne? Und dann hören wir mit dieser Runde dann auf.
Hallo, Benny Weintop, Jerusalem Post. Question for Dr. Clausen and Yossi Melman. In terms of sanctions, what we've experienced thus far is that these sanctions have increased oil and energy deals. Yossi mentioned the Swiss deal, 18 billion euro, which was just implemented, and the OMFAO deal. Isn't there then a need actually for a comprehensive embargo against Iran, particularly in the sectors energy and high tech, in order to slow down the Iranian nuclear war program, or perhaps bring it to a grinding halt?
Alexander Ritzmann, wollen Sie anfangen?
Ja. Dann Yossi Melman. Vogel-Strauß-Politik. Ich hatte natürlich auch explizit damit die Hezbollah-Politik gemeint, wobei die Hezbollah ja ein Werkzeug unter anderem, die haben auch ihre eigenen Ziele und Aktivitäten natürlich im Libanon, aber in den Fällen, die ich ja herausgearbeitet habe, waren sie ein Werkzeug iranischer Außenpolitik. Ich glaube, dass es kaum einen Politiker in Deutschland gibt, der nicht glaubt, dass Iran eine Bedrohung für Israel ist. Das ist nicht das Problem. Woran wir arbeiten müssen, ist herauszustellen, dass es eine Bedrohung für Europa und Deutschland ist. Und da kommt dann Hezbollah ins Spiel, die einen Rekord haben von Anschlägen, die eine Infrastruktur unterhalten in Europa, um diese Anschläge auszuüben, aber aufgrund der Anweisung aus Teheran-Beirut diese Anschläge im Moment nicht ausführen. Und die Bundesregierung sagt, sie weiß von alledem, aber da gibt es im Moment nichts zu tun, weil die machen ja nichts. Und das ist natürlich schon ein, wenn man jetzt das Sicherheitsinteresse der deutschen Bevölkerung mal in den Kernpunkt nimmt, eine sehr bedenkliche Position. Also es gibt eine Organisation, die in der Lage ist, hier Anschläge zu verüben, aber man lässt sie in Ruhe, weil sie im Moment sagt, sie möchte nicht zuschlagen. Das ist ja an der Grenze zum Absurden. Deswegen muss in dem Bereich aber auch mehr aufgeklärt werden, weil es ein Disconnect, eine mangelnde Verbindung zwischen der Arbeit der Sicherheitsbehörden und der Politik gibt. Wenn man die Arbeit der Verfassungsschutzbehörden, des Bundesnachrichtendienstes, was da zu lesen ist, wenn man sich das alles anschaut, dann hat man ein Bild. Das Bild hat nur niemand oder kaum jemand im Bundestag und in der Bundesregierung. Und deswegen gibt es ja Organisationen, die versuchen, diese Lücke zu füllen und praktisch der politischen Führungsklasse sozusagen in der Bundesrepublik erstmal vorzustellen, was die eigenen Sicherheitsbehörden an Bedrohungsanalyse produzieren. Und da ist sicherlich noch viel zu tun, aber es geht in diese Richtung.
Yes, I agree that there is a need for a comprehensive policy shared by all members of the EU and the Western nations. They should reach out to countries like India and others which are doing business with Iran. But at the same time, each government has also to do it on its own, whether it's the German government or it's the British government or the French government or the Austrian government for that sense. And if we wait to try to reach a consensus and to implement a comprehensive policy, it may be too late. We have seen how slowly the process with the United Nations Security Council has been. It takes time and to draft all these resolutions and to discuss them and then to implement them. So yes, a comprehensive peace is sanctions are important. A policy, unified policy, is important, but also each government has to be responsible for it. And I believe it's not too late to do it. Iran, if I use the words of Patrick, of the cultural revolution in which the Ayatollahs are very fearful of, I would say that economic sanctions would only increase that fear that the people of Iran would would be under the cultural revolution influence. They would feel that they that it would increase the discontent among them and the rejection of the regime. And as history has learned us, the Iranians know how to rush to the streets. I mean, they did it in 53 with the Mossadegh affair, and they did it again in 79 with these huge demonstrations which brought Khomeini into power. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility that we would see eventually another third wave of street demonstrations, which eventually may bring the government, the regime down.
You have the last word.
There is much we could do to make the economic sanctions work better. But economics is not the central concern of Khamenei or the other Iranian leaders. So we should add to our economic pressure more political and security pressure. The political pressure, Germany is very well positioned to help, because one of the big problems in achieving political pressure on Iran is Iran's perception that Russia will come to Iran's help. Germany has rich and deep relationships with Russia, and it is up to Germany to decide how important to make the Iran issue in its relationship with Russia. At the moment, I don't think it makes the list of the top 100 concerns, and the Russians know that. On the security front, we also must do more to show Iran that we will be prepared to deter Iran if necessary, and we must reassure Iran's neighbors that they will have a reliable defense against a nuclear Iran, and that therefore they do not need to pursue nuclear weapons on their own. And here I am particularly concerned about the case of Turkey. Turkey has a border of more than 1,000 kilometers with Iran, and the Turkish attitude towards Iran has been that, well, we have a balance of power. That attitude will probably change if Iran gets nuclear weapons, and especially if Turkey's accession talks go badly. Turkey could worry about the depth of Europe's commitment to its defense. Now, Turkey is a member of NATO, but the last two times that Turkey asked NATO to help defend it, Germany objected, in 1991 and in 2003. I think that particularly at a time when German-Turkish relations are delicate about the accession talks, it would be very useful if Germany were to encourage in NATO, NATO's military planners to plan for how to defend Turkey from attack from the east. And if Germany were to make clear that Germany feels that its commitment to NATO includes a commitment to defend Turkey from an attack from the east. Because I think it would be a matter of grave concern to many in Europe if Turkey decided it had to go down a nuclear route. A year and a half ago, I had the pleasure of being on a speaking tour in Greece about Iran's nuclear program. And I just suggested to the Greek audiences, does Greece have an interest in assuring that Turkey remains a non-nuclear country? So I would think that on both the security front and on the political front, there is much that we could do.
I very much thank our panelists, und ich darf mich Caroline Fetscher vom letzten Panel anschließen. Auch Ihnen nochmal ganz herzlichen Dank, dass Sie anstatt draußen in der Sonne herumzulaufen, sich hier mit diesen ganz wichtigen Dingen auseinandergesetzt hat. Und ich wünsche Ihnen noch weitere anregende Gespräche hier. Herzlichen Dank.